The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by Gabia Gadavascacha, who is political correspondent with the Irish Independent, and Aoife Barry, author and journalist. And we will start, Gabia, with your paper, The Irish Independent, which is leading with a story of, it says, Garda probe into explicit fake images of female politician. And what's interesting about this is these were AI-created fake images of this female politician deliberately created to try to undermine her chances of getting elected. So this is our first tangible evidence of AI in the Irish electoral process.
Yes, interfering with the Irish electoral process. My colleague Fionnán Sheehan reports this morning that malicious fake images of a female politician circulated during the general election and they're now being investigated by Gardaí. Now, these sexually explicit photos were created using AI deepfake technology in an attempt, presumably, to cast a slur on the victim's character. The smear campaign against the candidate, with one of the main political parties, is being treated as cybercrime. And I think he's reporting as well that it was a topless image of the woman. And of course, it was completely false. It was not a real image, and it was circulated on social media. And I think what's really scary about the story is that it can happen to literally anybody, but especially if you're somebody who is in the public eye. Of course, we know that AI is getting more advanced by the day, it seems. So what's there to stop realistic looking photographs being created that in turn seriously damage you and your campaign if you're a politician?
And she describes, there's a number of quotes about people who have suffered through a similar incident, and there's quotes from an MLA who had a similar thing happen, saying that the way that they discovered it was people smirking and sniggering at them and then making sexual references. Mm-hmm. And then they realise that this thing is doing the rounds. I suppose the issue with it is it's one of those of shutting the stable door after the horse is bolted. Even if you take legal action against it, if you're midway through an election campaign, it can have its effect in the week of the election and you're done.
Yeah, look, it's very much a reactionary, I suppose, response that you can provide to it. And really, is there a way of getting around it and getting ahead of it? The answer really is no, because once the damage has been done, it's a little bit too late. So even that SDLP politician saying, I was getting people smirking at me, sniggering, there was a lot of shame. I felt shame even though I hadn't done anything. Even though it wasn't me, it may well have been, because it was so widely believed. Like, how are you supposed to get back from that? Certainly very challenging. And I think this is something now that, unfortunately, we're probably going to see a lot more of, and certainly in future elections. And really, I don't know if it's something that Irish politics is ready for. I don't know if there is a way of getting around it. And it can be certainly very damaging for somebody who perhaps may lose a campaign, even though they've done nothing wrong.
And I assume the other thing in all of this, Aoife, is that whatever chance there was of increased circumspection and regulation by the tech giants themselves. Mm-hmm. Once we saw the result of the new US administration and its attitude towards those tech giants, there isn't a prayer of them now taking charge of any of this, is there?
Yeah, and when you look at also the words of the people like Sam Altman, who are some of the figureheads in the AI movement, shall we say, basically saying things like, you know, we have to prepare for things to get worse before they get better. AI is going to disrupt everything in the world. You know, they're priming us for the kind of negative impact of AI, while also saying AI will, in a positive way, change things for us. What they're actually saying is, like, nothing can be done about these sort of things. Obviously, there's legislation, there's harassment legislation. You know, there's Digital Services Act, which doesn't quite, I mean, this is kind of under that, but like, there are different ways of tackling, you know, cyber crime and AI crime. But we are in this, as you're suggesting there, this whole new area where huge powers like America are fighting around ideas of free speech, and what they believe is free speech is not what the rest of us believe is free speech, which could indicate, you know, a kind of a chilling effect around what could happen around these sort of images, and also means that this could become normalised in the sense of, like, nothing can be done about it, so you just have to live with it, which is why I was referencing people like Sam Altman there. But for me as well, another massive impact of this kind of thing is, you know, if you look, there's a study done about abuse against TDs and senators, and it found that 94% of respondents experienced some form of threat, harassment, abuse or violence during the course of their work. Aside from any AI stuff, right, or that could be rolled in with that, then there's a gender aspect of that. We've already seen all the discussion around the sheer lack of women who, you know, in the Dáil, at cabinet, sitting around the most important table in the country. And then you have the gender aspect of it, the women who are mainly being targeted with these sexualized images. That is legitimately turning people off, no doubt, going into this role. It puts this particular spotlight on women in particular in politics who already have things stacked against them, and now there's the fear, well, I could end up having these sort of images made of me. And it's really, really, the chilling effect of that is really scary, because I know for years I've been covering and reading about the, you know, the pressures against women getting into politics. This is just another layer on it. And it's quite depressing to realise that if you look at Cara Hunter from the SDLP, who we were talking about a moment ago, realising that people walking in the street had seen these fake images of her. Like, you know, anybody seeing that, is that's not going to, you know, impact positively on somebody who might want to get into politics.
Does the fact that they are fake images as opposed to real hacked images ameliorate their impact on the individual to any degree?
I don't think so, because I think there's the shame aspect, which is what Cara Hunter talked about in those quotes there. There's already a lot of shame around women, around sexuality, around, you know, their bodies. And that idea of being exposed, quote unquote, in that way, even if it's not a real image, I think is still going to have an effect on a person. And it's still, it's a way of minimizing and shaming women, we already know. So having a fake image of that is also doing the same thing as shaming women, trying to minimize her. And it's a kind of a tool that can be used specifically against women that isn't used in the same way against men. And I think the impact of it against a man is, because of the way our society works, is still going to be slightly different.
Although
to
presumably,
woman.
Shorn of the sexualized shame, aspect of it, the electoral threat remains the same. It may not be sexual images that are put up against men, but you would also get, I assume, fake pictures, fake reports, whatever else you want against election candidates.
Yeah, and you can also target it as to what is more shameful for a man than for women, right? So there could be other things. That's what misinformation does. It puts a target, it says this person is doing this or they look like this in whatever way they know will be most shameful against that person. So it might not be a nude image of the man, it might be something else that they know will maybe get people kind of second guessing them. And that's the danger of the world that we live in now, where, you know, very little is being done about these sorts of images. Very little can be done in some areas. And even if it can be done, do you have the money to go to court to try and do something about it? So I think it's pretty scary. And like Gabby was saying there, like the effect on the electoral process, like that is a scary thing too. When people go and turn up to the ballot box, do they have these images and these ideas in their mind? Is it actually affecting
people vote? If it hasn't been debunked yet, obviously it's something to think about when they're voting. The other impact of this, of course, is what we talk about never ending, it seems at this stage, but it's stopping women from participating in politics and political life. We saw gender quotas being used, the 40%, the higher gender quota for the first time in the last general election. Like, it didn't really make that much of a difference in terms of the percentage of women that got elected to Dáil Éireann, and there was a very small increase. But like, this is something else that you might consider if you're a woman who 100% wants to be in the political life, and you're saying, okay, maybe I can handle the social media abuse, maybe I can handle some of the threats, perhaps, maybe not having a constituency office. But like, if there's fake content circulating of depicting you, of doing things that you haven't done, like, why would you want to get involved in politics?
Also, if you fear that there's very little can be done quickly about it. So it's the idea, like, if it happens, it's out there. It's like, once the genie's out of the bottle, once Pandora's box is open, etc. The thing with the AI image and deepfakes is you can't roll back. Everything that happens on the internet can stay on the internet forever, even if you get Google to wipe, you know, the information off it. So what do you do when you live in a world where anything can be faked and it can be permanently on your record?
And even if you get Google to take the image, there's a line, I think it was a US transport secretary, I can't remember the man's name, who was accused and subsequently found innocent of what he had been accused of, but he gave a great quote afterwards, which was, can you tell me which room I go to get my reputation back?
Even
if this is debunked, the damage is still done. The people have still had their laugh. The demeaning effect is, you can't put any of that back into the bottle.
You can't put it back in the bottle. And when you're looking at American politicians like J.D. Vance trying to act like the EU, which is attempting to fight these things, is actually the aggressor and doing the wrong thing. And I can't even get my head around this because it's nonsensical, right? But when you're looking at that, then you realise what people are up against, because these issues are happening, but people who could potentially have power to affect the kind of legal situation around it and the greater perception and culture around it actually might not see it as the issue that it is. That doesn't really instill confidence in people that the future
of AI
is going to be.
Well, this goes to the regular debate that comes up, which is it a matter of education of the individual citizen so that you understand that you live in a world where you can't trust your eyes and you simply have to go on second source everything like you're a working journalist? Or is it a matter for regulators?
Yeah, it's a tough one, because I suppose as AI gets more advanced, the more believable these images get. I mean, some AI images that you see doing the rounds are very obviously fake. Now, look, some cohorts of the population, some cohorts of population will still fall for that, but some are very good and AI is getting more advanced. So is it a case of you shouldn't believe everything that you see on the internet? perhaps. But if it's an image of somebody who's in the public eye doing something embarrassing, I mean, that spreads like wildfire. And even then, if the person comes out and says, do you know what, that's actually not true, I'd say if the number of people who've seen the image is, you know, 100%, maybe the people that have seen the statement afterwards can be only about 30 or 40. Yeah. I mean, it's significantly less. It's very, very hard to roll back on the damage once it has been done. Like, it's an interesting challenge for the Oireachtas and Irish politics as a whole.
And the EU beyond.
I know that, you know, politicians are very concerned about it. You know, and certainly you hear talk about AI very often. It's kind of hard to get, I suppose, the public excited about it until something like this happens. But the dangers are there, and they have been there for a very long time.
Yeah, and I think that there's an idea, there's a kind of a cultural, you know, part of all of this kind of jigsaw when you're talking about the cultural approach or the societal approach to media literacy. If you look at a country like Finland, where from a very young age, young students are introduced to the idea of media literacy and what you're talking about there, Anton, of, you know, second sourcing things, of looking at primary sources, that becomes kind of built in as a very normal way to interact with the internet. And obviously they do that because of their position geographically and their neighbours. And we know there's a lot of, you know, Russian disinformation and things like that. So they're doing that because they know that young people, as they get older, are going to encounter potentially fake information online. In Ireland, we're late to the game, really, when it comes to that. But we do have people working very hard on the idea of media literacy. But that's the kind of part of the puzzle where you have to have people understanding that they need to have media literacy. They need to
see. I wonder
everything.
About that. I think that's predicated on an assumption that each individual wants to all the time walk an objective line and try to find truth.
Yeah, which
but
they
the algorithms
don't.
Most individuals want to find that which confirms their existing preconception.
Yes.
Therefore, you're not going to, if you see something like this and it tickles you where you itch, that's grand. I'm not going to second source that.
That's the thing. And you can't, I mean, media literacy, I do think if it's built into the culture from a young age, it has more sticking power, right? But at the same time, you are correct in that, like, not everybody in a room is going to have the same perception of an AI image or understand the impact of it or even want to even bother looking to see if it is. And that is the problem that we're up against because, like you say, you know, the horse is bolted, you know, stable door is closed now. So what do we do? And it's, I wish we could all sit around and be like, oh, this is what we should do. And then that'll solve that issue. But it is kind of an unsolvable issue in one way, but there are things we can do to try and make it less.
But take this case in point. I mean, we're going to be talking about it in more detail in a while, but if you look at what J.D. Vance said in Munich, J.D. Vance made a speech in which he suggested that prayer was being illegalised in private houses in Scotland, that public prayer was being illegalised in England, that the Digital Services Act was acting to impact and reduce the capacity of people to have free speech, all of which are either gross distortions of reality or complete lies. But it is being reported as a searing attack on it, as if it is grounded in truth.
Yes.
And it will be reported back at home as truth.
I think we are living in, you know, that, you know, that saying, may you live in interesting times.
Interesting times.
I've been a news reporter for
a curse.
It is a curse, exactly. I feel like I've been a news reporter for probably about 20, you know, 18 years or something. And every year it's gotten more and more intense and strange, and the last 10 years has been really weird, and I don't think I've ever worked through a period, and I'm sure there's other people like yourself who've worked through weird periods as well, where the truth and reality are just so confused with misinformation and fakery, and having to deal with people like Trump and Vance who say things that are absolutely untrue, and having to have the media reporting them as if they are true or as if they can try and get a little edge of, you know, perhaps this isn't true in there. It's really confusing for people. It's confusing for reporters. It's confusing for people reading the newspaper, watching the news, listening to the radio. And that means that things like this, which are predicated on fakery, are even more difficult for people to understand.
But you don't even have to look at what J.D. Vance is saying. I mean, like, misinformation is completely rife on social media platforms, even here in Ireland.
Yeah.
I think I saw one crime reporter even tweeting, was it yesterday or the day before, how there was just totally false stories circulating widely on social media. And when the journalist goes off to do their job, they find out that there's absolutely no base to them. I mean, you know, one incident may happen and then the next thing you know, there's a narrative there that's been constructed by bad actors online for their own purposes, not really clear what they are, that spreads like wildfire and people believe it and they say, and I think the pandemic certainly triggered a lot of that and made it so much worse, and it hasn't really gone away since then. I mean, you know, the facts, quote unquote, that we saw circulating on social media, and people believed them, that the government was, you know, doing things for one reason or another completely false, that restrictions would be lifted or the restrictions were coming back and they're kicking in next week and nobody's telling you this, but I have a source in Leinster House saying this. I mean, rubbish. Like, there is no base to it. So how do you fight it when it's allowed to go unchecked on social media? And of course, now on social media platforms, it seems that they're rolling back on things like what they would call censorship. But what that leads to is completely false information circulating widely.
And just very quickly, two things of that. One thing is that they're not even calling it censorship, they're calling it speech. So now free speech has become speech. And you can say whatever, you know, you can make that word speech mean now whatever you want it to mean, which is really worrying because language is changing. It used to be free speech, now it's just ordinary speech. And then secondly, you know, during, you're dead right about the pandemic period, that period was so bad for misinformation that all of the platforms had to roll back and it had to, you know, hire people to work in trust and safety, hire moderators. We saw a really good push towards trying to curb it. And now all of that.
And
is
of course,
being
the critical
rewind.
Thing in that is there is a sense that social media is a free and equal sharing of everybody's expression. But it is editorialized through an algorithm that selects what it presents to you, which means there is an onus on that editor, albeit a technical editor, to make sure that it is true, the same way there is a newspaper. It is not just an open forum of random discussion.
No, and the problem is, to get to the kernel of a lot of what we're talking about, it's being presented by the people who run these platforms as if it is a space where anybody can say anything. And that gets back to our truth, you know, our reality versus what's being said. These platforms are run by people who have a certain idea of what free speech or quote unquote speech means. And if they believe that what you say is, it, you know, shouldn't be said, they will censor you effectively. And we live in a very, very weird time where nothing really means what it used to mean anymore.
Meanwhile, closer to home, one of the things that seems to be coming, and Gabi, you can tell me if this is the sense that you're getting in Leinster House, but it seems that profligacy with the public purse and uncontrolled spending is becoming more and more of an issue. The OPW had been taking the brunt of it for a while, but front page of the Irish Times today, Arts Council spent 9 million quid on consultants, including, if I have this correct, several million went on an IT project that was a bridge to nowhere that turned into nothing.
Yes, of course. So we had this scandal erupted during the week with the Arts Council when Patrick O'Donovan, who's the newly appointed Arts and Culture Minister, brought their long-delayed annual report of 2023 to Cabinet. So they've basically spent the guts of 7 million of taxpayers' money on an IT project that was first initiated in 2018. That basically has not materialised, was hit with many delays, the contract just changed.
7 million quid pays for a lot of poetry, I would have thought.
Perhaps, but that money has basically gone nowhere. Now, the Arts Council are hoping to salvage some of that, to get some of it back through legal redress. But we know that the senior civil servant in the department, the Secretary General, last June initiated this review of what went wrong. And so Catherine Martin, who was the minister at the time, you know, there was questions being asked there over what she knew, what and when. I think Roderick O'Gorman said on this a show or program yesterday on Pat Kenny, saying that she knew before the election, but she was waiting for the civil servant to finish carrying out the report so that everything can be brought to Cabinet as a whole. And that's what Patrick O'Donovan has done. Now, you can imagine Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael ministers very much so pointing the finger of blame at the Greens. But since that scandal has broken, obviously more details have been emerging. And one of those is how they've spent 9 million euro on consultants, according to the body's annual report. The staffing at the council also increased from 36 people employed full time in 2015 to 114 in 2023.
Sorry, give me that again.
So from 36 in 2015 to 114 in 2023.
I think,
and there was a big, I will
they've
also
tripled
say,
the staff.
I think what's missing there though is the context of the huge cuts to the Arts Council during the recession. So their budget was absolutely slashed, and now they're trying to recover. I think people are forgetting the fact that from about 2001, 2002, 2003, their budget was cut heavily. Even if you go back to 2013.
It's recovered well, 140 million last year.
It has, but for years, for at least a decade, their budgets were cut. And now they're trying to build back up because there's so much demand for the Arts Council to fund artists that they need more staff. And I mean, if you want the art sector and the green wave to grow, you do need an infrastructure there to support artists. So you need people working within the Arts Council to do the job. However, the issue is, why are you also getting in consultants and paying the millions to upgrade an IT system, which anybody who's applied for anything on the Arts Council
will tell you
needs to be upgraded. I think the issue is more the consultant issues there than the idea of them having more staff to try and do a better job in the Arts Council. Now, I don't know what everybody in the Arts Council...
Well, I think they needed the consultants because they didn't have the
staff.
Some
and there's a reliance on that within all government departments too. Sorry to cut it, but I just think that that element is being missed, that it's like they're hiring people for a reason because they were underfunded and they were understaffed for a long while.
How do you measure that?
I think that's a good question. But I think if we know the facts are that during the recession there was massive discussion around the cuts to the arts budget. Massive.
But sorry, my point being, if you fund or don't fund a hospital, you end up with people dead. There is an outcome.
Yeah.
If you fund or don't fund roads policing, there is a measurable outcome in terms of road debt. Underfunding the arts, have we got an actual measure where we can see, well, if we don't pay it this, X happens? What's X?
Well, I think the answer.
Well, you're such a pessimist, Anton.
No, yeah, I mean,
there may be an X. I just want to know what it is.
Look, well, I think it's all working towards Irish culture, which is beautiful, correct, by the way. And okay, you may say, well, it's not funding for hospitals or whatever else. But like, if you apply that thinking, mm-hmm, then we'd have
to everything. Then,
we'd have only the very basics in place that perhaps may be functioning quite well, but nothing else on the side. I mean, in fairness, like the Arts Council does do important work. Artists get grants.
So give it 30 billion.
Well, no, but no one's giving it 30 billion.
So that's somewhere there is a value. That's what I'm asking is what's the measure of value?
But the thing is, like, how do you measure arts value?
But you can't measure, like...
You measure in terms of how many people are still working within the industry. Or if you look at something like, I mean, this is a bit trickier one because it's Screen Ireland, which aren't the Arts Council, right? But if you look at the film industry and we look at the film, the Green Wave, we look at somebody like Cillian Murphy's gone all the way to the top, and we look at the, you know, film like On Colleen Kuhn, which is funded by Screen Ireland. The money comes from the government and the success that has at the box office, that's measurable, right? Not every film though has to be as good as that, mm-hmm, and to go that far. I mean, the Screen Ireland did have a report where they said that basically, I'm going to mess this up slightly, but the figure is 1 billion in terms of the impact that the film industry, mm-hmm, has in Ireland.
Commercial revenue, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. You've thousands of people work within the arts industry in Ireland, and I think if we get down to an idea that every single, to go to what Gabby was saying, if every single person who, like myself, I'm a writer aside from being a journalist, if you had to measure what I do and my output in terms of have you made X, Y and Z, you can't measure it in the same sort of way, just as you probably can't say with the hospital, have you cured 50% of, mm-hmm, people who are attending the hospital of whatever illness they turned up at the door with.
But that's what they do.
You can in certain ways and you can't in others.
They measure you and they benchmark you against other hospitals both in Ireland and around the world.
I still think that we're talking about the wrong thing, because I still think that, like, if everybody's celebrating the Green Wave and saying that that Ireland's doing so well in Hollywood, blah blah blah, that's because of investment, that's because of the government funding Screen Ireland and because of investments that's put into the arts. You're talking about long-term investment in things. Like, if you're talking about the president that is sitting there in Áras an Uachtaráin right now, when he decided to restart the film board, which was closed down by Charles Haughey, presumably there's some, pulling of purse strings involved there, he decided to reopen it. And because of that, we then had success in the 1990s in Hollywood. Because of that, we now have massive success. So, listen, I'm not an economic person. I, you know, did pass maths in my leaving cert, but I do know that when you're talking about measuring things, it goes beyond the numbers that are ticked on a spreadsheet.
It does make the case very difficult, though, for the Arts Council when they're out there fighting the good fight, as they would say, I'm sure, for Irish artists and bolstering and fostering Irish culture, to then come out and say, yes, we did spend 7 million, the guts of 7 million on an IT project, which, by the way, was scrapped, and now they're looking to get something off the shelf, and so they still have no replacement. So the systems that were previously in place are still there. And if you look at, as I have been going through these many reports for my day job, there is a series of options that was laid out by the Arts Council, and they were all deemed, and the ones that suggested we might keep a form of this system, or we might maybe build on it a little bit, or just keep going as it is, they were all deemed non-viable, and that was back in 2018.
Interesting text, Gibby, on what you're saying. I spent my entire working life in the IT industry. We delivered major IT systems to the private and public sectors. 9 million in consultancy and 7 million for a failed IT system is beyond belief. This is a scandalous waste of taxpayers' money. It makes my blood boil. You could deliver 10 systems for this kind of spend. View 53106. And actually, we're going to be joined by Sinn Féin's finance spokesperson, Piers Doherty, tomorrow to talk about both the Arts Council funding and the issue of cost controls across government more widely. But staying on an arts topic, Aoife, one that you have skin in the game of.
Well, I don't know about that.
The fight between the Eurovision judges led by Donal Skean and Samantha Mumba continues to make the papers. Double page spread featuring an awful lot of discussion around aubergine emojis. I don't know why these have been so significant. But she
I won't explain on air.
She is suggesting making very clear that the judges were not qualified to do their job and were only there effectively to grandstand. You have been a judge.
I was on the judging panel, your original judging panel, not the Eurosong. Like the people that are chosen to judge in these on the panels are people who either love the Eurovision, love, like they love music, they know what a good song is when they hear it. And I have, you know, sat in rooms of people who bleed the Eurovision and know instantly what a good Eurovision song is.
So if I cut Donald Skean, he bleeds
Literally,
Eurovision.
Literally, he would bleed Eurovision. Like, you know, there's two elements. There's picking people who are great on TV and know, you know, and people recognise. So the panel were picked because they know the Eurovision, they love Eurovision songs, and also people know who they are. And I think, you know, I do feel sorry for Samantha Mumba. I'm sure turning up there, being somebody who has the reputation she has, she's been around a long time, she, you know, she's a great singer, she's a great presence, she would have been great to send to the Eurovision. But like, on the night, the song didn't work for the judges. And like, when you listen back to their feedback, it's not that bad. I've heard way worse, you know, said in public to people's faces.
You said way worse when you were on the panel.
I was saying, well, yeah, that wasn't all televised, thankfully. But, you know, I think really it's a bit unedifying to be that public, I think, and using those sorts of emojis about something. It is sad for Samantha, but I mean, don't use aubergine emoji when you're giving out about these things.
Yeah, so I think Donal Skean was saying, look, Samantha's in a phenomenal part of the Irish history, but he's saying you need a minute and 30 seconds before you get to that big Samantha Mumba moment. Bambi Thug saying the song could do with a revamp, for example, but it wasn't, of course, until Dancing with the Stars judge Arthur Gournoulian. He spared no punches, describing the song as akin to 10 different demos put together in a pot, mixed together, but no chemistry between the songs. I couldn't relate to it at all. I'm so sorry.
Which led to your old bozos choke on aubergines. Aoife Barry, author and journalist, and Gabia Gadavascacha, political correspondent with the Irish Independent. Thank you both very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.